It surprises just about nobody to find out that, once again, minimum wage in much of the country is just not enough money to afford a decent place to live and keep it under a certain percentage of income. The only surprises are within the numbers in this year's out-of-reach report from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. As in recent years, the report finds very few places where minimum wage and 40 hours of work will rent a house. We'll get into the details of the report in the hour and get some perspective on how the issues unfold in our region. Diane Yentel is the president and CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition and joins us by phone. Thank you for joining us, Diane.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
And we also have in the studio to talk about situations in the Rogue Valley. James Raisin is Support Services Director for Access, Inc., the action agency in Jackson County. Hi, James.
Hi.
And Michelle Glass is with us as well, the director of the Rogue Action Center. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
So let's get a brief description at first about what each of your organizations does on housing. Diane, let's start with you and the nature of the report and the other stuff you do.
Sure. So I work with the National Low Income Housing Coalition. We're a national membership organization that's dedicated solely to achieving socially just public policy that ensures that the lowest income people have decent, accessible, and affordable homes. We work with our members across the country. We have about 1,100 organizational and individual members around the country. We have a broader network of close to 40,000 interested people and organizations. And we work really closely with about 62 state partners in 42 states to achieve our work. We do our work through research. All of the policy solutions that we push forward are grounded in data and in research. We do organizing, we do education, and we do lobbying on the Hill to encourage federal members of Congress to invest in the solutions to make homes affordable for the lowest income people.
And let me ask about just that one part of it for a moment, about how much receptivity you get from Congress to the issues you present in reports like Out of Reach.
Well, I think members of Congress generally are appreciative to have such detailed information about how the housing crisis is impacting their constituents and their local communities. And I will say, you know, we can talk more about this throughout the program, but despite the enormous challenges that we're facing at the federal level, despite the threats of cuts to or elimination of really critical programs to make homes affordable for the lowest income people, we have actually had some success in recent months with some increased spending on key programs and some important policy provisions that are moving forward as well.
Okay, we will ask about that a little later in the program. James Raisin at Access, Inc., tell us a bit about what Access does in housing in Southern Oregon.
Well, we really have kind of a two-pronged approach to housing. We develop properties and manage properties that are affordable for our low-income residents. And we also have rental assistance programs and various other means of helping those who are low-income to actually be able to get into housing.
And then the Rogue Action Center, Michelle Glass, what do you do with housing?
So the Rogue Action Center is a community organizing hub for the Rogue Valley, and we work directly with impacted, mostly renters, across Jackson County. Our primary mission is community empowerment, leadership development, community organizing, kind of connecting impacted community members with policymakers so that the policies that that get passed at the local and state level are in line with real community needs so that we can move forward together.
I can't imagine that there's anything in the report that you have heard about thus far, just in general, about Out of Reach that surprises either one of you. James Raisin?
Doesn't surprise me at all. Just really confirms what we've seen on the ground.
Okay.
Absolutely. I think that this report for us is a call to action above all else.
So, Diane Yentel, much change from previous years, because the issue seems similar to what we talked about a year ago, where if you're making minimum wage and working 40 hours a week, it is nearly impossible to keep your housing under the HUD percentage that is recommended.
Yeah, it is. It continues to be a really severe crisis. What we've seen over the last several years has been that the housing wage has increased by about a dollar a year, which is an acceleration of the increases that we saw in years previously. The housing crisis clearly is pervasive. It's impacting communities across the country, from urban to rural to suburban, and especially for the lowest income people, the crisis is really severe. So our most recent report, Out of Reach, calculates what we call the housing wage, and that's the amount that somebody has to earn an hour just to be able to afford a modest, safe rental home without spending more than 30% of their income on housing costs. And the housing wage this year, like in years past, clearly shows that the cost, housing costs are simply too high for low-wage workers and other vulnerable households. So nationally, the housing wage for 2018 is $22.10 an hour for a two-bedroom apartment and about $18 an hour nationally for a one-bedroom apartment. It's about the same in Oregon. It's about $21.26 an hour to afford that two-bedroom apartment in Oregon. It's quite a bit higher in California. It's over $32 an hour to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment in California. So clearly the rents for the minimum wage workers, even in states and cities and counties where the local minimum wage is higher than the federal minimum wage, even in those instances, the housing costs are far out of reach for them. But they're also far out of reach for average renters. So nationally, the average renter earns about $17 an hour, which is $5 less than the fair market rent for the national two-bedroom apartment. So it's not just for the minimum wage workers for whom the rents are out of reach. It's for those average renters, too. And another thing that we're seeing that we highlight in this report is that this is going to be a challenge for the foreseeable future, because 7 out of the 10 occupations that are projected to add the greatest number of new jobs by 2026, they provide a median wage that's less than the one-bedroom housing wage. So this includes jobs like personal care aides, home health aides, nursing assistants, you know, emergency medical technicians, retail folks, food service workers. So those jobs that we're going to see grow the most by 2026 pay less than the one-bedroom housing wage.
Okay, break time on the Jefferson Exchange. Back in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about housing and the cost of it in America and the fact that when you're working minimum wage, you generally have to work a whole lot of hours to keep your housing cost under that 30% figure that we'll talk about the genesis of that figure in just a moment. But it's reflected in this year's edition of the Out of Reach Report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Diane Yentel is the president and CEO and our guest by phone. In the studio to get some local perspective, we have Michelle Glass, the director of the Rogue Action Center, and James Raisin, the support services director for Access, Inc. Join us and tell your story. Let us know what your situation is with trying to afford housing on what you make now. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Diane, I want to explore one aspect of the Out of Reach Report. We are talking about just one income. Is there any factoring in of a second income and the effect that produces?
Sure. I mean, we actually break down, if you go to our website at nlic.org, you can find the housing wage needed for all bedroom sizes from studio to one up to five bedrooms. So we use the two-bedroom housing wage most often to talk about it, because one, two-bedroom apartments are the most common size and the most common need throughout the country, and also because the data for those two-bedroom apartments are the most reliable. But certainly, when we look at the housing wage for the one-bedroom apartment as well, they're far out of reach for both the minimum wage earners and average renters. We also have to consider, you know, why people might need a two-bedroom apartment. There are a lot of very valid reasons for that. There could be single parents with multiple children in need of multiple bedrooms, that having a second income in the household is not necessarily realistic. But even when we're looking at the minimum wage workers, and we find that in some communities, certainly many of them in California and in Oregon as well, you know, multiple jobs, well beyond two full-time jobs, are needed to be able to cover those rents.
Give us a sense, if the two Rogue Valley folks would, of anecdotal stuff that you hear and situations you're aware of where we're seeing people getting into the housing crunch. Michelle Glass from Rogue Action Center.
Yeah, so one of the things that the Rogue Action Center does is we go door-to-door across Jackson County and we talk to folks. We knock doors every week. And so I think some of the things that surprise me when we do that door knocking is how many seniors we talk to who are at risk of losing their housing because their fixed incomes are not keeping up with regular rent increases. So a lot of folks are seeing rent increases every 6 months. And there is no state restriction and no local restriction that puts a cap on how much those rent increases can be or how often they can happen. And so that's really increasingly impacting working families, people living on, with disabilities, and seniors. And we're hearing that on the doors. And so to hear folks who say, I helped, you know, I've raised my family here. I've worked here my whole life. I helped build this community. This is where my, this is my community, and I want to age in place. But I, if the rent, with this next rent increase, I'm out. You know, I don't know what else to do. And I think that has real implications for what our communities look like, and also for the quality of life and economic security of our seniors. And that's really concerning. I think the other thing to keep in mind is when we talk about the minimum wage, the average age of minimum wage workers is 35 years old. So we're not talking about teenagers starting out. We're talking about working families. And minimum wage is a big part of the service economy, which is demanded by our large retirement population here that relies on services. And so I think we have to keep in mind that our service-based economy is here long term. These are families working these jobs who have to be able to find housing. Employers need stable workforces, and affordable, safe, stable housing is part of that. And so I think that that's some important context to keep in mind when we think about who these folks are that are being impacted and what that means for our community.
In the process of knocking on doors and getting stories from people, do they show you their letters and show you what the reasons given are for their rental hikes?
Oftentimes there isn't a reason given. So the rent increases are just every 6 months, like clockwork. Usually there isn't a reason given. Similarly with no-cause evictions. Every renter, which is about 40% of our population, every renter in Jackson County is 30 to 90 days away from losing their housing because of no-cause evictions, for no, you know, because of no fault of their own. This is unconscionable, and it's really putting the stability of our families at risk and having detrimental impacts on particularly children.
James Raisin, you seem to be responding too about people not getting reasons for the hikes. Is it just, you know, are they giving told anything like it's, you know, it's what the market will bear? This is what apartments like this are worth now, that sort of thing?
In my experience, no. They're just, there's no reason. They don't have to give them a reason. So they don't. It's only going to cause, you know, give them a chance to push back. So they, I think they'd rather just give them the notice and that's it.
So with the kind of programs you run at Access, I mean, I have to believe you're getting called a lot for housing services, and there are potentially wait lists too. So give us a sense of what kinds of situations people are contacting you with and what you're hearing.
Similar to what Michelle was talking about, you know, people's rent is going up. The frustrating thing is we may be able to give them some temporary assistance to keep them in their home. But if the rent is going up, our assistance can't last forever. And if it's more rent than they can afford, they're going to fall back into the same situation. So until we fix that problem, our temporary assistance isn't going to be a help in the long run.
So your programs are set up, I assume, to hit certain rent levels and certain situations of family size and income and that sort of thing. And if the circumstances change, you're suddenly inadequate, or the money that you're providing or the assistance you provide just doesn't match up.
Right. We do, and we do have minimums. We find families living in dwellings that are too small for their family. Our programs won't allow us to pay for that just because it's inhumane. But that's really the only place they can actually afford on with their own income. So once again, it's just it's a huge problem.
Diane Yantel, you already gave the wages required to afford a two-bedroom rental home. In California, it's $32.68 an hour. In Oregon, it's $21.26 an hour. I do need to ask, though, about, we were talking about the minimum wages that are present in each of the states, though. Those are the calculations here?
Yeah, we calculate the housing wage. The housing wage is based on how much you actually have to earn.
All right, but the hours of work, for example, that you need to work at minimum wage, which is 119 in California and 79
right.
in Oregon, those are based on the minimum wages in effect in those states?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So I do want to zero in on that one aspect of the numbers, the index used for affordability. We've talked about that 30% issue. That's a federal HUD number?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's been around for decades, and national experts and folks who run the national housing programs agree that affordability is paying no more than 30% of your income towards your rent. What we find in this country is because we have both such a severe shortage of homes affordable for the lowest income people, and we have chronic underfunding of the programs that make homes affordable for the lowest income people, that we have close to 11 million people, most of them severely low-income seniors, people with disabilities, or families with kids that are working really low-wage jobs, that are actually paying over half of their income towards rent each month. They're considered to be severely cost-burdened. When you're paying more than half of your income towards your rent each month, and you have limited incomes to begin with, there's very little left over for, you know, healthy food, for stuff your kids need for school, for transportation, much less to be able to save for your future, for your education, or savings for retirement. And it leaves folks at really high risk of not being able to absorb a financial shock in any one month. And it can be something as small as, you know, a broken down car that needs to get fixed in order to show up at work that day so you don't lose your job. That's the kind of unexpected expense that when you're paying so much of your income towards rent each month can actually lead to you not being able to pay the rent and facing possible eviction, potentially spiraling deeper down into homelessness eventually.
We were talking about the high cost of housing here on the Jefferson Exchange. Diane Yentel is the president and CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, which puts out the annual Out of Reach report, which this year shows pretty much more of the same. In about 22 counties in the entire country, can minimum wage get you a two-bedroom rental home? That is not a great story for a lot of people. We have Diane on the line with us. James Raisin is the Support Services Director at Access, talking about situations with housing and housing assistance programs in the Rogue Valley. Michelle Glass is the Director of the Rogue Action Centers. We talk about ways in which we can work our way out of this. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Share your ideas about what you see, what you've experienced yourself, and what you think should be done to correct the mismatch between wages and housing. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And if folks are wondering, Hawaii is the most expensive state, so ranks ahead of California there. Arkansas, the cheapest. So in Hawaii, you need to make about $36.13 an hour for a two-bedroom home, and in Arkansas, $1,384 is enough for that. James Raisin, how much public money comes through Access to help house people?
Oh, goodness. We get, in totality, just for rental assistance, we're talking about millions, over a million. We also have our energy assistance and other things, which also help to keep them in their housing. To make that rent more affordable by offsetting some other costs, and that's many more millions, but it's not nearly enough.
So is there a housing director, too, I mean, or support services about housing and a bunch of other things, too?
We do also have a housing director, and he actually oversees our properties and our property development.
All right, but you take that in and also took a look at other ways that you can support people not living in homes that are built by Access.
Right, support services, it's kind of the front-facing dealing with the actual people.
So when we talk about program that money, public money that funnels through Access, I have to believe there are limits and caps on the money, and wonder if those ever slide upward for more expensive markets. Is there any allowance made for the fact that for example, living in southwestern Oregon is more expensive than living in far eastern Oregon?
So most of our programs follow the HUD guidelines for fair market rent. We're not allowed to pay for a rental unit that's not within the FMR guidelines.
What is the fair market rent in the Rogue Valley right now for homes and apartments?
Oh, goodness. I didn't come prepared with that. Mm-hmm. But for a one-bedroom, I believe it's around 700 mm-hmm. or so, high 600s. Two-bedroom in the 800s.
Okay.
It's too low. It's lower than the average rent.
All right. So the fair market is different from what people are actually paying.
The true fair market in the real world is higher than what HUD's standards are.
So, Michelle Glass at the Rogue Action Center, I mean, what do you see as the obstacles or the things that actually push housing costs up in the first place, and then obstacles to getting more affordable housing built in the region?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I'd just like to add some local context to the severely cost burden numbers. So 1 in 3 Jackson County renters are paying more than 50% of income on housing.
1 in 3. Okay.
1 in 3. And so clearly, you know, this is a huge problem in our region. And so I think there's really three things that we need to do if we're going to get a handle on this. I think we all believe that there's no silver bullet. This is a really complex problem. But there are proven solutions out there. And I think the first thing from the Rogue Action Center's perspective that needs to be addressed is the fact that a lot of these policy decisions, whether you're talking at the state level at city council or planning commission the local level at city council or planning commission or at the state level, are made by people who are not impacted, and those folks aren't part of the conversation. So these are conversations happening between developers, landowners, and often elected officials who aren't renters themselves. There's not one renter in the state legislature that I'm aware of.
Not one. Not one. 90 people.
Right. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of landlords. So there are certain perspectives that are being privileged in these conversations over others. And that's, I think, leading to some of these problems and really shaped the solutions we've seen in the years past that have not been adequate. So we need to increase the voice of impacted community members in these processes. And that's number one. I think the next thing we need to do is we have to stabilize the rental market. There's a lot of discussion about this is supply and demand. We just need to build more units. But if we don't first stabilize the rental market, two things will happen. One is every month that we fail to stabilize the rental market, we lose more people to intergenerational cycles of poverty. We have children losing access to a stable future. We have seniors losing access to the ability to age in place and live healthy lives in the communities that they, that they've lived their lives in. And we can't get that back. We're losing people to homelessness, increasingly families, seniors to homelessness, and our safety nets aren't prepared for that. The second thing is, if we only invest in building new housing, we know that's years out. So by the time that housing is ready to rent, it's coming in a much more inflated market, right? And so if we don't get a handle on the instability in rising rents, then that new housing is going to come in and at a price that's out of reach for the people who need it. So I think if we can increase community voice, rebalance who's driving these decisions and what perspectives are included in that, stabilize the rental market by banning no-cause evictions and repealing the state ban on rent control, and then make sure that we're developing not just housing full stop, but the right kinds of housing, the housing our community needs, in the right places. So things like close to transit, accessible housing for people with disabilities in our senior population, and housing at all affordability levels, then I think we can get a handle on this and we can move forward.
All right. So when you say stabilize the rental market, I think you gave the clue there at the end about eliminating the ban on rent control in Oregon.
We need, to stabilize housing. And we're hearing this increasingly from local city leaders who are in the face of lack of action at the state level, last year to repeal the statewide ban on rent stabilization. Cities are getting calls from tenants saying, hey, I just got a 40% rent increase and I'm going to be on the street next week. Can you help me? And cities are saying, scratching their heads and saying, no, we can't because there's a state preemption. And we see the impact here and we want to be able to do something, but the state has tied our hands. And so until we lift that ban, it's going to be very difficult to address this at the local level.
So Michelle just identified that there are probably no renters in the Oregon legislature. I imagine the chances are even slimmer in Congress, Diane Yentel. So you mentioned that Congress is actually doing some good things, but give us a picture of HUD funding at the moment and what the trend has been. It looks like since 2010.
Sure. Yeah, since 2010, Congress at that time implemented really tight spending caps that have been in place since that time under what was called the Budget Control Act. So since 2010, we've had a slow bleed of funding for key federal housing programs and a real precipitous decline in some of them, including some of the block grant programs. A few times since 2010, Congress has kind of given itself relief from those tight spending caps and lifted them. And thanks to some really strong advocacy from resident leaders and advocates across the country over the last year, Congress did lift those spending caps again a few months ago. They lifted them equally for both the defense and the non-defense side of the budget. And then our congressional champions who prioritize affordable housing programs were able to get a really high percentage of that increased spending for HUD's programs. The end result of that was that for FY18 spending bill, we had a 10% increase to HUD's budget. Now, if you think about that in the perspective of, you know, we started the budget process with President Trump proposing 15% cuts to HUD's budget and proposing to entirely eliminate many of those programs, for Congress to end that process on a bipartisan basis with a 10% increase to HUD's budget was both a really clear and obvious rebuke to the president's vision for affordable housing programs in this country, and it was a pretty historic swing between what was proposed and what was funded. It was also historic in a one-time increase for HUD's budget. Now, that 10% increase is really important. It means more vouchers, rental assistance for low-income people across the country. It means more money to repair public housing. But even when we consider that 10% increase, we're still well below our 2010 spending levels on these programs, so we have a lot farther to go.
Okay, and I have questions about what the optimum levels might be. We'll come back and talk about those after a break. Diane Yentel from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, James Raisin from Access, Michelle Glass from Rogue Action Center talking about housing in the region. You're welcome to join the conversation when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the high cost of housing in America, which, yes, gets talked about a fair amount, but this time there's some real numbers to put behind it, because we have the most recent report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition, the Out of Reach report, indicating just how long you have to work on minimum wage in any state in the union to be able to afford a two-bedroom rental home. And in California, you have to work 119 hours a week, which is sort of impossible. And in Oregon, it's 79 hours a week at minimum wage to afford a two-bedroom rental home. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about the issue nationally and within our region as well. We have Diane Yentel, the president and CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. James Raisin, the director of support services at Access, Inc. in Jackson County, is with us as well, along with Michelle Glass, the director of the Rogue Action Center. You can join at 800-838-3760. Share your story about rent increases and your ability to pay. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So, Diane, to come back to the discussion about funding for HUD, which you said is still not quite as robust as it was in 2010 when the Budget Control Act was passed. I mean, is there a figure you have in mind that might, you know, with the amount of money needed to sort of backfill where HUD was?
Well, you know, if we were to go back and see a time where we didn't have the extraordinary housing crisis that we have today, especially for the lowest income people, we'd actually have to go back to around the late 70s when there was a surplus of homes that were affordable and available for the lowest income people. Today, there's a shortage of over 7 million homes affordable and available for those lowest income people. So the difference between then and now, there's a lot of differences, but one of the main ones was that we were funding at the federal level at far greater degrees the creation of homes affordable and available for those lowest income people, mostly through the public housing program and the project-based rental assistance program. So starting in the late 70s, the federal government put a stop to building any new public housing and slashed HUD's budget in the early 80s to about today, it's about half of what it was back then. So we need to spend significantly more at the federal level on the solutions to the affordable housing crisis, increase rental assistance, and increase supply of affordable homes that are targeted towards those with the lowest income through programs like the National Housing Trust Fund program. So it's not a cheap solution that we have to actually have the political will to invest at the scale necessary to solve this crisis. But I will say that when we invest in affordable homes, we find savings throughout the federal government. So when people are affordably housed, there's research that shows that their healthcare costs fall by about 12%. And when people are affordably housed, their educational attainment increases, their lifetime earnings, right, and their increased tax base increases. It even increases their life expectancy. So there are savings to be had through increased investments in affordable housing.
All right, so 7 million housing units short across the country by this estimate. And then does either of you have a number for the Rogue Valley, Michelle Glass or James Raisin? about how many units you think are needed?
So those numbers come from city-level housing needs analyses. And so, like, for example, I don't have one for Jackson County, but Medford's missing it. A conservative estimate from their 2010 housing needs analysis is 4,500 units affordable to households making $25,000 a year or less. But even small communities like Talent, where I live, we're missing 600 units, which is a significant percentage of the units that we need to build that would be affordable to households making less than $25,000 a year.
And for example, Access has how many of its own rental units, James Raisin?
I want to say the high hundreds.
All right.
Yes.
So less, fewer than 1,000. Yes. And I can imagine there's a wait list for people getting into those?
Most of them have a wait list. Many of them also serve a certain demographic as well.
What kind of a demographic? I mean, I know you have some veterans homes.
They're all for low income. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, yeah, it may be for veterans. It might be for someone with mental health needs, families.
I noticed Access also provides a comprehensive list of not just the homes that you own, but all affordable housing in Jackson County. And I just wonder what the general picture is of getting into the more affordable places.
Most affordable places have waiting lists to get into them.
And any idea how long people spend on those waiting lists?
It could be months. For the Housing Choice Voucher, I mean, everyone's heard the stories. It is literally, you know, 3-4 years it can be waiting for vouchers. But just even to rent a place that you do have enough income for, you can wait months to come up on a list.
Now, the vouchers, again, are based on the fair market rent, not on what's actually being charged?
The limit is set by that fair market rent calculation.
And Diane Yentel, I know that the FMR is the figure that you compare against here. And is the actual rent actually somewhat higher than the FMR in most places?
So the fair market rent is set at the 40th percentile of rents. So there are certainly rents that are higher and lower than the fair market rent. HUD, there's a number of issues with the fair market rents and the way that they're set. One is that they're based on data that is often 2 years behind, and given the way the rental market has been changing so rapidly in recent months and years, it can be out of date, and the local housing costs can, in fact, be much higher than what the fair market rents say that they are. Another challenge is that fair market rents are set at the metro level, and you can imagine a number of metro areas where there are multiple housing markets within that metro area, some places where the housing costs are much higher and some places where they're much lower. HUD has been moving towards shifting the way that they set those fair market rents through a small pilot program that's called Small Area FMRs to set those fair market rents at the zip code level rather than the metro level, so it can be a little bit more accurate in reflecting the local housing costs.
And if people are wondering what these fair market rents look like in a really big city where the housing is really crunched, San Francisco, for example, the hourly wage necessary to afford a two-bedroom at fair market rent would be, you'd have to make $60.02 an hour, is the look at San Francisco. Let's see, for Los Angeles, $31.98 an hour. So not a lot of people make that kind of money, so we're talking some hard things to do here. Beyond the numbers, Diane Yentel, as we get into talking about potential legislation, things like rent stabilization, rent control, does the National Low Income Housing Coalition track how many states allow rent control of some kind?
No, we don't. I think there's other organizations that do. We focus our efforts on the federal housing solutions, and then we work to support our state and local partners on their efforts at the state and local levels, because clearly there's solutions needed at federal, state, and local levels. I just wanted to go back for a second, if I could, on the question of the wait lists that
Sure.
you raised. That's a really important one, and it goes to, you know, the chronic underfunding of federal housing solutions. We have a system in our country where just one in every four households that are in need of and eligible for housing assistance get any help at all. So 75% of the households who are eligible and need housing assistance get turned away, and they get no assistance at all. And they're the ones who are adding their names to, you know, you heard about months long, years long. There's cases where it's even decades long waiting lists, because Our federal housing system for the lowest income people is essentially a lottery system, and it's the lucky 25% who actually get the help that they need.
Another caller here, Tony in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about housing and wages. Hi, Tony.
but you haven't talked much about wages. The other side of the ledger surely is people can't afford, apparently, to buy housing. The reason why people can't afford to buy housing is because their wages are low. And we've tried a minimum wage and go to Seattle and realize that doesn't work. So the reason why wages are so low is because there's such a huge supply of uneducated or semi-educated people in this country, particularly here in the West, where Oregon and California has amongst the worst education systems in the country. And the reason why that is exacerbated is because we have people from such splendid places as Chiapas and Oaxaca streaming across the border. So if you increase the supply of low-educated people, it's inevitable that you can't increase their salaries or their wages.
But, Tony, the unemployment rates are very
limit
low.
That. Sorry, are you trying to interrupt?
I'm asking you, the unemployment rates are very low, so that would seem to indicate
there's
that...
There's a lag. Obviously, this is going to improve. It's always a lagging indicator. You've heard that expression. The fact is, though, that by limiting the flow of people across the border, particularly people who really are not necessary to the new economy, ultimately there will be an increase in demand. If you go to an area where
immigration,
very
I want to get
high...
some answers here. Thank you, Tony. So is immigration a part of this, James Raisin, do you think?
Honestly, I don't know. I think Michelle probably has more to speak on that end.
I think there's no basis, in fact, for that allegation. It's an emotional based appeal. We hear it a lot, but we know that the data shows that that's not the case, and we also know that regardless of who's here, we have demand for jobs in the service economy and in agriculture. And this isn't about education. I mean, education is important, but this is about the way that our economy is structured and that there is demand for jobs that will always be lower paying jobs. And so we have to get a handle on housing costs if we're going to be able to have a stable community and a stable workforce. And that's just where we're at.
Tony did provide a pivot to the issue of wages, though, which that has been worked on as well. So Oregon does have a minimum wage, as does California, above the national minimum wage. And that doesn't seem to help at all, though, because it seems like the numbers keep going up on both sides of the equation.
Yeah, I mean, so I was part of the coalition that fought to increase the Oregon minimum wage. That's important work. We do need to keep working on wages. But as with most things, we can't just work on one piece, and we can't keep saying, well, we're not going to address this because it's something else. I think we have to address all of these. And in spite of that fact, we've seen the average rents for a one-bedroom in Jackson County rise almost 60% in the last 3 years. And there's no way that you could increase wages enough, especially the minimum wage, to keep up with that. We have to get a handle on the instability in the rental market. And I also want to bring it back to what these numbers mean to real people in our community. There were nearly 3,400 homeless students across Jackson and Josephine County last year. And affordability and lack of rental protections are a huge driver of that number. I don't think that that's acceptable for our community, and I think most people would agree. And so, I think that we need to deal with the fact that it's still legal in our state for landlords to do secret, no-cause evictions for families. No one knows about these evictions except for the landlord and the tenant. And
secret,
the landlord,
secret from whom?
Well, they're not tracked. They're not reported. So we don't actually have data to tell us how often it's happening. And the families are just told that they have to move, even though they haven't done anything wrong.
They have 30 days, though, right?
30 days, is the minimum. But in a constrained market like ours, where often the vacancy rate is hovering at 1%, if you have a family, that is, James is nodding his head, that's nearly impossible. And so how will a low-income renter hope to find a new home they can afford in Southern Oregon in 30 days? In most cases, you not only have relocation costs, but you're often looking at a rent increase if you're getting into new housing.
How much does anybody think that, and I'm going to take Mark in Mount Shasta's question because we're running out of time, about the Airbnb and people keeping homes as vacation rentals. How much does that impact the market? Diane Yentel, a quick answer nationally, does that appear to be having much of an impact?
It does have an impact, especially on the very low vacancy, high cost markets like many that are found in California or in Boston or New York City. There's some research that shows really clearly that in those type of markets, taking rental units off the market to be used for vacation rentals is having a negative impact on the costs of rent for low-income people.
And that appeared to be the case in Southern Oregon too, Michelle Glass?
We're just starting to see this take off. I know it's been an issue in Ashland. I don't have data on it.
All right, just about a minute left for a point that appears to be a big one, which is profit-taking. I mean, if you build a whole bunch of more housing units, unless you take the profit motive out to with rent control or something, the rent hikes will trigger others at some point, won't they? So even if you build a bunch of units, you still have that issue.
Yeah, we know that especially large out-of-state landlords, that is a business model, that they will charge whatever they can. And in Oregon, without leadership and action at the state and local levels, right now it's however much they want.
Do you have the ears of legislators? Do you think they'll be going for things like rent stabilization?
I think that we will be mobilizing in 2019 and calling on our state and local leaders to take action.
All right. An issue now and one that will continue into the future, as shown in this year's Out of Reach report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Diane Yentel is the president and CEO. Diane, thank you for joining us once again.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. Michelle Glass, the director of the Rogue Action Center, and James Raisin, the support services director at Access Inc., thank you for joining us for a local perspective in the Rogue Valley.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for the conversation.
Sure. And that'll do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. You can find out more about the program online at jeffexchange.org. The program is produced by John Baxter and April Ehrlich, Patrick Fitzsimmons at the controls. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time and have a great day.